Hello there.
Betty Lou.
And right now, we pick them up at... Oh, God.
Tommy made me bang you up.
Some perfume for a hospital, Mrs. Mack. Oh, for a lady.
Well, we have a sale on this perfume today. It's called Forbidden Fruit Number 5.
Forbidden Fruit Number 5?
Yeah.
It's... Strong.
Strong. It won't sit under the apple tree with me.
Betty Lou. Betty Lou. Betty Lou, where are you? Betty Lou.
Well, gee, I guess I'm lost.
Uncle Tommy!
Well, if it isn't my little neighbor, Betty Lou.
Oh, gee, I see neighbor.
Hello,
Mrs.
Wingate. What are you doing in this department store all by yourself?
Oh, I came
here
with my Uncle Tommy, but I lost him.
Well, if you're lost, it's very fortunate that you ran into me. But then I always shop in the more exclusive places.
Yes, Mrs. Wingate, it's lucky I came down to the bargain basement.
Well, I'm buying myself a dress for Christmas, and you might as well tag along, Mrs. Wingate.
Are you ready to try on your new dress?
Yes, Mrs. Brown.
Oh, would you mind stepping into that dressing room and removing your old dress?
Not at all. Come on, Betty Lou. Well, Betty Lou?
Are you sure you want me in there?
Well, of course, child. I want to keep my eye on you.
Well, okay.
Oh, I'm glad you're here, Betty Lou. Stand on that chair and pull the zipper down my back.
All the way down?
Well, of course.
All right. Oh, boy, bloomers.
And what's wrong with bloomers, may I ask?
Oh, nothing, except that I didn't think they wore them anymore.
Well, I like them. They keep my knees warm. Now, I wish you'd hang up my dress while I take my girdle off.
Oh, Mrs. Wingate, don't you think I ought to step out?
Why, no, no, you're not in the way.
Well, I'd like to step out just the same.
Oh, I can't understand you, child. Why?
Well, I was in the room once when Mrs. McIntyre took her girdle off, and I don't want to get pressed against the wall again. So there, there.
Oh. Of all the ridiculous things, you have more imagination than...
Betty Lou.
Why, Betty Lou, your Uncle Tommy's calling you. You better run out to him.
All right, Mrs. Wingate. Oh, gee, Uncle Tommy, I'm sorry I got lost.
Well, that's all right, Betty Lou.
And Uncle Tommy, remember when I walked into your gymnasium and I laughed at the way you looked?
Yes.
Well, I apologize.
Well, why?
Mrs. Wingate wears them, too.
Betty Lou, how many times have I told you not to...
Oh, looky, here comes my boyfriend, Wilbur. Hello, Wilbur.
Well.
You know, you're late. You miss Santa Claus.
Uh-huh. But I couldn't help it. I was having lunch with my dog.
Wilbur, do you mean to say that you eat with your dog?
Oh, sure.
Oh, Wilbur, you shouldn't do that.
Well, why not? They're his dogs, Mr. Tate.
Well, Wilbur, I can't understand how a big boy like you can be in Betty Lou's class. You're 15 years old, aren't you?
Uh-huh.
Then, Wilbur, how come you're in the third grade?
Well, I worked hard.
Well, Wilbur, I looked for you at school today, but you weren't there.
Yeah. You want no supper?
What, Wilbur?
I played hockey.
Hockey?
Yeah. I tell that to my mother, she gives me a piece of cake.
But you're saying it wrong, Wilbur. You should tell your mother you played hooky.
Hey, I tried that once, and she smacked me in the foot.
Well, Wilbur, you're a moron.
Oh, no, I ain't. I'm an idiot now. I've been reclassified.
Well, Wilbur, while we're in the store, are you going to buy me something?
Oh, I don't have to, Betty Lou. I brought you something.
Oh, gee, what is it?
My pet turtle.
But, Wilbur, you said you wouldn't fight with your pet turtle for anything in the world.
I know. But I want you to have it now.
Well, gee, Wilbur, why?
It died this morning.
Oh.
At this point, to our great audience over here, we bring a completely uncensored, non-military bit of information to wit.
There are only four more shopping days before Christmas.
And since that still finds many of us with a lot of shopping to do, may I very humbly point out that the finest Christmas gift in the world for anybody to give anybody is a United States war bond. Christmas money spent on war bonds or stamps can do something your Christmas money never did before. It can save a sailor from drowning. It can bring a wounded Marine back to health. It can mean the safe return of a flying fortress to its base. Or it may mean sinking a U-boat or blasting a Zero out of the sky. So buy bonds and stamps and give bonds and stamps this Christmas. Instead of giving those you love useless knickknacks, give them war bonds or stamps. For in that way, you're also giving those you love and who are fighting for you guns and ammunition, helmets and life belts, grenades and gas masks. Make this the Christmas you help save an American's life by buying and giving war bonds and stamps. Our regular listeners, and I think I may assume that we already have quite a body of the faithful, our regular listeners will recall that Ronald Coleman has been, up until now, performing the pleasant duties that have fallen to me tonight. This week, however, Mr. Coleman, that extremely active actor, was forced by events to take a train back to Hollywood. He'll be with us from Hollywood a bit later, if the train arrives on time. The Treasury top sergeant who ordains these matters has assigned me to the NC detail, and I, in turn, have persuaded my friend and colleague, James G. McDonald, to assume my own news department chore this evening. For a short summary of the week at home, directed to the boys over there, here's James G. McDonald, Blue Network, News Animal.
For most Americans, this has been a week of fuller awakening to the grim fact that the war must be fought here at home also. Millions of us on the eastern seaboard were startled into a new awareness of the demands that this global struggle will make upon us for the sudden invalidation yesterday of our A, B, and C gas ration cards. The first effect of this drastic temporary regulation was like an unexpected cold shower. We were shocked, but we are already beginning to feel the happy afterglow of warmth which comes from the knowledge that we are helping but just that much to speed the day of victory. The resignation of Leon Henderson, courageous and uncompromising flight administrator, is officially attributed to poor health. The task of fixing prices and building banks against the dangerous tides of inflation has been, as President Roosevelt put it in accepting Mr. Henderson's resignation, difficult and thankless. Mr. Henderson has labored unstintingly. His successor not yet named will have the onerous assignment of continuing the fight to save us all from a ruinous rise in prices. Mr. Henderson's withdrawal has given us a better perspective from which to estimate fairly the nature and the importance of his work. The adjournment of the 77th Congress, after one of the most continuous and arduous sessions in American history, has led already to a reassessment of its legislation. Divided and querulous when it convened in January 1941, the Congress grew in unity as the members realized more and more clearly the necessity of putting the war effort first. Their accomplishments have vindicated our faith in the processes of democracy. This week, our teenage boys, by answering for the first time the draft call, gave youth unhesitating and clarion reply to the active threat to our freedom. The return home of Eddie Rickenbacker, after his nearly miraculous escape in the Southern Pacific, does more than cheer us. It reminds us that this pioneer airman and those who today are following his dauntless example are giving our country what will be the greatest air force in the world.
Reach their maximum power. Will, we now see, depend upon how well we civilians play our various roles. No one of us is too humble to hinder or to help. Former President Hoover gave last Wednesday night another demonstration of the kind of nonpartisanship which enables democracy to function. His program for a lasting peace at the end of the war does not differ in essentials from that laid down by President Roosevelt, Secretary of State Hull, and Undersecretary of State well. He and they united, emphasizing the truth that our country is intimately and permanently interrelated with the rest of the world, and that our peace depends upon world peace. Mr. Hoover and the leaders of our government are in agreement. We as a people, if we are to have any hope that our children's children may be spared another global war, must join with the other nations in establishing and maintaining an effective world organization. Thus, the events of this week have made us understand better than before how victory depends on us here at home, and how a real peace at the end of the war depends upon the continuing cooperation of all the civilized people. One of the things we try to do on this program is to give the men abroad some notion of the important trivia, if you'll permit such a contradictory phrase, of life back home in wartime. For example, there's a new movie making the neighborhood rounds at the moment called The Powers Girl. It includes a new tune called Out of This World. And here's a lovely lady to sing that song for us all, Miss Jane Froman.
The moment I saw you, I started to dream of all I was. Your eyes outshine every star. I hold your hand, and the moon is jealous of me. You're out of this world, heavenly queen. Whenever you're near me, my hammering heart amazes. With every kiss, there's a thrill that's new. With every kiss, I go off of this world with you. Off of this world. Whenever you're near me, my hammering heart. With every kiss, there's a thrill that's new. With every kiss, I go out of this world.
Bulletin from Hollywood. Ronald Coleman's train did arrive, and he awaits now our space-annihilating cube. We have a new task for Mr. Coleman. Beginning next week, over here, we'll ask leading United Nations writers, statesmen, and philosophers this question. What shall we hope for from a United Nations victory? What should be the nature of the new world for which we have sent our sons to war? Their answers, Mr. Coleman will read. Appropriately, to introduce our thinking about the future, we consult tonight the past. For a tribute to the soldiers of our own land who have given life itself to make a better world for all the children of men, we go back 2,371 years. Once upon a time, all those many, many years ago, the words you will hear tonight served as a eulogy for the young men of Athens, who died in defense of the Athenian democracy. Dignified as they are by antiquity, these words may now serve to honor our own dead in the same timeless struggle between good and evil. We hear a part of the oration of Pericles over the fallen soldiers of Athens. Mr. Ronald Colt.
Before I praise the dead, I should like to point out by what principles and under what institutions and through what manner of life our country became great. For I conceive that such thoughts are not unsuited to the occasion, and that this numerous assembly of citizens and strangers may profitably listen to them. Our form of government does not enter into rivalry with the institutions of others. We do not copy our neighbors, but are an example to them. It is true that we are called a democracy, for the administration is in the hands of the many and not of the few. But while the law secures equal justice to all alike in their private disputes, the claim of excellence is also recognized. And when a citizen is in any way distinguished, he is preferred to the public service, not as a matter of privilege, but as the reward of merit. Neither is poverty a bar, for a man may benefit his country, whatever be the obscurity of his condition. There is no exclusiveness in our public life, and in our private intercourse we are not suspicious of one another, nor angry with our neighbor if he does what he likes. Because of the greatness of our nation, the fruits of the whole earth flow in upon us, so that we enjoy the goods of other countries as freely as our own. I have dwelt upon our greatness because I want to show you that we are contending for a higher prize than those who enjoy none of these privileges, and to establish by manifest proof the merit of these men whom I am now commemorating. Their loftiest praise has been already spoken, for in magnifying the nation I have magnified them and men like them whose virtues made her glorious. None of these men hesitated to resign the pleasures of life. None of them put off the evil day in the hope, natural to poverty, that a man, though poor, may one day become rich. In the face of death, they resolved to rely upon themselves alone. And when the moment came, they were minded to resist and suffer rather than to fly and save their lives. They ran away from the word of dishonor, but on the battlefield their feet stood fast. And in an instant, at the height of their fortune, they passed away from the scene, not of their fear, but of their glory. Such was the end of these men. They were worthy of their country. Make them your examples, and esteeming courage to be freedom and freedom to be happiness, do not weigh too nicely the perils of war. To a man of spirit, cowardice and disaster coming together are far more bitter than death striking him unperceived at a time when he is full of courage and animated by the general hope. Anyone can discourse to you forever about the advantages of a brave defense, which you know already. But instead of listening to him, I would have you day by day fix your eyes upon the greatness of your country until you become filled with the love of her. And when you are impressed by the spectacle of her glory, reflect that this nation has been built by men who knew their duty and had the courage to do it, and who in the hour of conflict had the fear of dishonor always present to them, and who freely gave their lives to her as the fairest offering which they could present.
The new Treasury program, Over Here, we'll continue in just a moment with Ronald Coleman, John W. Vandercook, Ilka Chase, James G. McDonald, Jane Froman, Igor Gorin, Susan Hayward, George Murphy, Tommy Riggs, Joe Reichman, David Brookman,
and the Treasury Orchestra and Chorus. We pause now for station identification. This is John W. Vandercook again in New York, nudging Act Two of Over Here toward a rendezvous with a microphone and with two audiences. One audience listens now, over here at home. Another listens later, over there in uniform. If you will use your imagination, again you can place both great audiences under one infinite roof. Yes, we live in a single great house, all of us. The mother at home, the boy in the islands of the South Seas, the wife in Peoria, and the husband in the Tunisian hills. We are all children of one house in this time of trial. For that house, in the season of Christmas, here's a wish in song. The singer, Igor Gorin.
Pray, make it so. realize about your husband, your son, they care more about when he's going overseas than you, but not for the same reason. The more knowledge they have, the more efficiently they can plan his death. They don't need a lot of information. Often one small detail tells them all they want to know. Are you going to be the one to supply it? Let's picture a little scene in Berlin. The office of the chief of German intelligence sits at his desk. There's a knock on the door, and a caller is announced.
Heiliger.
Senator, sit down.
Do you have news?
Not a great deal. Just a report from one of our agents in the United States.
Well, get on with it.
This agent overheard a woman in a restaurant say to a friend, "I'm afraid this is very unimportant."
You fool. Nothing is unimportant these days. Go on.
Heiliger. This woman said she had a son at Camp Johnson. That's on the coast. And she told her friend that from a hint he gave in his last letter, she knew his regiment would embark sometime this coming week.
And you call that unimportant? Get out! Get out, you stupid swine! And that little piece of news, given by a loving mother to a trusted friend, added to the other bits she had already accumulated, completed a picture. Picture of death. So a ship was sunk, and boys who were willing and ready to die fighting were never even given a chance to fight. The enemy wants to know where your boy is training, how he's equipped, when he's going overseas, how many will accompany him, and what kind of duty he's been trained for. Without that knowledge, your enemy's hands are tied. And so they have to depend on each one of you to supply it. Make it tough for them. Don't talk. What you read in the papers or hear over the radio is public property. You can repeat that without danger to those you love. But what has been written or told to you in confidence is your sacred trust. Keep it solemnly. Remember, a thoughtless speech may be some boy's death sentence.
We've been taking ourselves much too seriously for some time now. A good cure for that trouble, I think, would be another hop to Hollywood. There on the Glamour Coast, the Army, Navy, and Marines have a date tonight with our Glamour Girl of the Week, red-headed, deliciously ornamental Susan Hayward. We have assigned George Murphy to engage Miss Hayward in assorted small talk, while we use our imagination once more to picture those much-pictured eyes, lips, shoulders, and so forth. Mr. Murphy, representing the armed forces in general, meet Susan in person.
Thanks, John. You know, it's a sense for you to talk about glamour, but that's a thing that's getting very hard to find these days. Most of the Hollywood glamour girls are now doing war work, canteen work, or they're even doing their own housework. And I'm sure Susan Hayward here will back me up on that.
I certainly will, George. Believe me, even housekeeping isn't easy nowadays. What with temporary shortages of things like butter and eggs and coffee and meats and stuff.
It's a funny thing, though. You can't get anyone to agree on what he misses most. What do you miss most in your kitchen, Susan?
A cook.
Is that all? Well, make me an offer.
Ooh, can you cook?
My dear Susan, I always say cooking is merely a matter of intelligence.
Hmm, you can't cook then.
Now, let's not be vindictive, Susie. I can name you any number of great men chefs. You name me one famous woman cook.
Well, how about Delilah?
Delilah, a cook?
Well, she cooked Samson's goose.
They tell me she was a fair barber, too. I tell you what, my pretty red-headed detractor, why don't you drop over to my house some night and get a gander of me whipping up a dinner for the family?
I'd love to do that, George. But first I have to know this. When you prepare dinner, what does the family get?
Indigestion.
Just as I thought. I'll bet you never really did any housework.
Oh, is that so? Now, look at these hands. Well, I'm almost ashamed to put them on a pool table.
Are you any good at cleaning and sweeping and putting a house in order, George?
Well, I'm pretty good, but it's so hard to get any work done with all the interruptions. I mean, just as you're getting started, that butcher girl tells you where you can go if you want meat. Then there's that blonde girl that comes to read the gas meter, you know. She takes a little of your time. And the Fuller Brush girl rings the bell all the time. You know, I think it's awful the way she sticks her foot in the door and insists on coming in, even though she can see I'm just in my smoking jacket.
George, I'll tell you something, and this is no nonsense. Of all the people I've talked to who are just learning to do their own housework, most of them enjoy it.
Listen, Susie, nobody's going to beef about anything he or she has to do to free more people for work in the war plants.
Most of them enjoy it.
Listen, Susie, nobody's going to beef about anything he or she has to do to free more people for work in the war plants.
Of course not. But what I meant to say was that people are beginning to enjoy their homes the way their parents used to.
Sure. With gasoline rationing, the finance man doesn't get around so often.
And folks who used to sit around wondering what to do every evening now know what to do.
Sure they know. The ironing.
Right. Can you press your own pants, George?
Can you?
We kid about it a lot, but I think it's wonderful the way women are taking over men's work in so many places. And in a lot of other places, men are taking over women's work.
Well, it's got to be like that to keep a war and a country going at the same time.
You said something then, George. I mean about keeping a war and a country going. I've often thought about that, and, you know, it's a funny thing. It seems to me if we don't keep the country going as best we can while the boys are away, there isn't much use in what they're doing. We've got to preserve for them everything they're trying to preserve for us and everything they want to come back to. You know, I know I don't get all these economic and industrial theories about it, but I would like to say to you men in uniform that everyone here at home is trying to match your devotion and sacrifice, your bravery and your courage. We want you to be as proud of us back home as we are of you, off there in a lot of dirty, hot, ugly places with beautiful romantic names. We know there's nothing romantic about those places, and we wish that you could know the feeling we all get way deep down inside when those places are spoken of. Because we know you're there. And we know what you're doing there. Believe me, men, we know. And we'll never forget.
This is Ronald Coleman again. I've been deputized by that treasury sub-sergeant Mr. Vandercook mentioned to tell you that this is Joe Reichman's orchestra playing a tune very much on its way to the top. It's called I Had the Craziest Dream. The singer, Penny Lee.
I had the craziest dream last night. Yes, I did. I never dreamt it could be. Yet there you were in love with me. I found your lips close to mine, so I kissed you. You didn't mind it at all. When I'm awake, such a break never happens. How long can a gal go on dreaming? If there's a chance that you care, then please say you do, baby. Say it and make my craziest dream come true. Thank you. and make my craziest dream come true.
Presenting now, Ilka Chase, noted actress, author, and lecturer in Jefferson City Goes to War. A dramatic review of events and attitudes over here since that memorable December day a little over a year ago when we discovered the hard way that we were a part of the world at large. Ilka Chase in Jefferson City Goes to War.
Going to be a lot. Hard work and military discipline were going to do the boys a world of good. Even the boys in our town of Jefferson admitted that cheerfully as they marched away.
What have I got to lose? I've got a little time before I aim to settle down to business and get married. Let's live. Join the army and see the world.
It was over 2 years ago that the National Guard boys left for regular army training. There were 103 boys from Jefferson in the first outfit to go. And that was a lot of men out of a small town like Jefferson. There was a little parade and some conventional crying over them, but no one really worried.
There isn't going to be a war. Tell them I said so.
The war was far away. The European war wasn't our war, and the Japs wouldn't dare attack great big Uncle Sam.
Sure, you think they're out of their minds or something?
They were, in a much more sinister way than any of us could imagine. But we didn't know that then. Well, first thing anyone knew, our National Guard boys were really beginning to see the world, just as the advertisements promised.
Dear Mom, you will probably be tickled to death to know that I'm going to spend the winter where it's nice and warm. On account of we're better trained than the new drafted men, they're sending us to the Philippines. Some of the boys are going to Honolulu, but I'll have Manila. Get it, Mom?
And so forth. It was good, invigorating bodybuilding training, and it was all in fun. We didn't know that just about that time, the brethren in the land of the rising sun were preparing to act on the following sound Nipponese principles of warfare. These 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 principles of
always hit a man when he's won. Always hit a man when he's
won.
Always hit a man when he's down.
Two,
always hit well below the belt. Punch strongly in the clinches.
Three,
the voice of options speak louder than words.
And so forth. Dear unreal, sickish, our happy kids that we sort of looked upon as oversized boy scouts. All at once, they were soldiers. They were men. Vicious and ruthless an enemy as ever there was. And there wasn't as akin to the boys in Company A. Mrs. Delaney wrote her boy John a letter.
Again? You had a touch of it. And it wasn't fun then. Or everything is as slick as a trap.
What do you know about that?
Some letters and getting letters back. It didn't seem real. It was war. And sure as fate, some of our boys would have to die. It was hard to take. We didn't want to take it. We skipped it in everything we said.
They're going into business together when my boy gets home from the war. Wilson and son, yes, sir.
Don't you touch that shortwave set of Johnny's now. If he finds anything wrong when he comes back, he'll take you up back. 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 He'll take you up.
Someone got a pound. Until someone got a pound. Brave and proud idea. Pretty brave and proud idea.
They don't mark the passing of. Before long, there were a lot of. Corregidor was gone. Well, some of them were. People used to walk down the street looking. It was hard to read little fellows who've grown up like the Boy Scouts. Jefferson Town without them. It couldn't work. It was hard to see voices.
In the army. The boys are going to Honolulu.
Then we really began to come at the matter we got. We got on ourselves. Mrs. Deer,
my boy would be fighting now.
Mrs. Todd, your son.
Of course, partly.
We've got a few remarks like that, and if I read or heard the bulletins and tightened the muscles in the corners of them, they didn't say a thing. Salvage guards used to be a nuisance. They didn't mean anything. They meant something now. We didn't keep a thing that we thought a soldier could use. The druggist made up a package for the boys.
Quinine. The bitter is all get out, but it's sweeter than chocolates when you're down with a fever. There's plenty of other stuff that's good enough for us back here. Plenty.
The wheels began to turn. More wheels and faster. Dinner kept on getting cold on tables in Jefferson.
Hello, Mildred. Sorry, I'll be home late again tonight. Can't help it, Millie. Gotta work. Don't wait up for me.
Boys went to work on farms to bring in the crops. White-collar men got grease on their collars. Glamour girls got grit on their glamour and broke their nails. Teachers went to school to learn hand trades. Accountants drove lathes. Clerks ran bill presses. Transition. Boys into men. Girls into women. Men and women into one beating, driving purpose. Town into a fortress. Town into an arsenal. Town and townspeople into one beating, driving purpose. Victory! And soon, the sooner the better. Take our money, we said. Take our skills and our wills and make iron and steel and powder out of them. Take our sinews and pack them into the cylinders of engines. Cool them with our sweat. Take our comforts to have your necessities. Take our necessities to protect your lives. What's ours that ought to be yours? Name it and you've got it.
If you don't see what you want, ask for it.
If we don't have what you want, we'll make it for you.
Name it.
Claim it.
Take it.
It's all yours. That's what happened in Jefferson. We did all we could. We're doing more than we thought we could or had to. We're not finished. We want to be able to face the boys that come back. We want to be able to face the boys who won't come back. Comes Reveille on Judgment Day. There were 200 men in the next troop that marched away, and we knew, and they knew, that this time they'd have the most and the best of everything it takes to give the Axis the worst of everything they try to take. They'd have weapons, they'd have food and medicine, they'd have everything it takes if they had to take everything we had. They'd never have to surrender again. They wouldn't have to give up, because we weren't going to let them down. Not anymore. We'd found out what all America and every American was going to have to find out sooner or later, and the sooner the better. We'd found it out the hard way. We'd found out that an army can't win alone. We found out that this wasn't a war for an outpost or a base or a colony, but a war for every foot of American soil, for every home and field and ear of corn. A war without quarter and without compromise. A war for city and town, village and open field. A war for the freedom of decent men, for the people and by the people. And we are the people, everybody. And it's our war. We found it out the hard way, but it's everybody's war.
What happened to the town of Jefferson happened to all of us. We had to grow up to the realization that this was a different kind of war, an all-out war. To our enemies, that meant bombing open cities, machine-gunning tired women and children as they struggled along crowded, dusty roads. It meant taking every scrap of food a conquered nation had and leaving its people to die by slow starvation. Well, we don't play that way. We've got another set of rules. We have our own notion of an all-out war. It includes a magnificent outfit of fighting men in every corner of the globe. Men who fight on battlefields.
It includes a record for production of planes, ships, tanks, and guns that takes your breath away. And it includes every one of the rest of us who have one job in common, to equip those men. Lend your country enough money to do it right by buying all the war bonds and stamps you possibly can. One good way to be sure you're doing your share is to set aside 10% of what you earn every payday for war bonds and stamps. Millions of patriotic Americans are doing at least that right now. Are you one of them? If you aren't, decide this very minute that you will be. That you'll lend at least 10% of your weekly earnings to your country, so it can preserve not only our way of life, but life itself.
From the land, from the sea, in the air, we'll be there, we'll be there. So tell Uncle Sam we're prepared. We'll be there, each one to do his share. We'll keep marching along a 130 million strong, united the world will see it through. From land, from the sea, in the air, so help us God, we'll be there, we'll be there.
Next week at a new hour from 7 to 8 p.m. Eastern Wartime. Listen at home next week at 7 o'clock Eastern Wartime. Listen with your men in the service. Over Here is written in New York by George Faulkner and in Hollywood by Carol Carroll. Jefferson City Goes to War was adapted by Milton Geiger from the 20th Century Short Subject. Additional material tonight was written by Thelma Ritter, Joseph Moran, Arthur Stander, Sam Perrin, Jack Douglas, and George Balzer. West Coast Productions by Don Bernard. William B. Murray is executive coordinator with the cooperation of the Office of War Information and the Hollywood Victory Committee. The entire production is under the personal direction of William A. Baker. This is James Wallington speaking. This program originated in Hollywood and New York City.
This is the Blue Network.